Hello, listeners. This is Carolyn Yeager, bringing you the fourth installment of the Wehrmacht War Crimes Bureau, 1939 to 1945, which is a book written by Alfred de Zayas from the surviving files of this bureau. In this program, I'll be reading chapters 7 and 8. Chapter 7 is titled, The Use of Bureau Investigations White Books. So the discussion is going to be about German white books. Official German publications during the two world wars were issued as white books or white papers intended to present the German side of a given question. This chapter is concerned only with white books dealing with violations of the laws of war, and in parentheses, not with those on historical or diplomatic topics, and the role of the War Crimes Bureau in their formulation. The German Foreign Office had the exclusive authority to issue official white books, but no clear decision had been made at the beginning of the war regarding the right of other government agencies to issue similar publications. When the War Crimes Bureau compiled 5 volumes of witness depositions on atrocities allegedly committed by Polish soldiers and civilians before and during hostilities in September 1939, no clash with the Foreign Office took place because the Bureau did not publish the volumes but only forwarded copies to various government agencies, including the Foreign Office. 1 year later, after the French campaign, the Bureau did print a black book on violations of the laws of war by French soldiers and civilians. This very much resembled the official publication of the Foreign Office, which, jealous of its prerogatives, reacted promptly. In a note dated 14 December 1940, Councillor Stahlberg informed the Deputy Chief of the Legal Department of the Foreign Office, quote, I must point out that publication of white books is exclusively within the competence of the Foreign Office. The proposed distributions outside of Germany of a white book issued by the High Command of the Wehrmacht is likely to arouse much opposition by the foreign minister. Foreign minister, of course, the head of the Foreign Office, which was at that time Ribbentrop. Thus, I consider it necessary to inform the High Command not to do anything with this exposé except in close cooperation and with the approval of the Foreign Office, unquote. In order to avoid an altercation, the Bureau limited the circulation of its black book, advising all recipients that its use was restricted and that its contents were not to be published or passed on to persons outside the Wehrmacht. Not satisfied with its victory, the Foreign Office again objected to the second volume of the Bureau's compilation of French war crimes. On 10 May 1941, Konrad Rüdiger expressly warned the legal department of the Wehrmacht, quote, the Foreign Office requests that the printed report, French Illegal Warfare, 1939-1940, and any other reports with similar content, shall be made public only with the approval of the Foreign Office. At present, the publication of this printed report is politically undesirable, unquote. 2 days before, the legal department of the Foreign Office had gone even further in dictating to the Wehrmacht, saying, quote, the present printed report, because of its form and cover, gives the impression that it is an official German white book. The foreign minister reserves for himself use of this form for publications on foreign policy matters. The OKW, OKW, shall therefore choose a different shape and a different color for all future publications, unquote. Thereafter, the War Crimes Bureau employed smaller-sized paper when, for example, it published in April 1943 a 24-page booklet on the Gneisenau massacre. In spite of this apparent rivalry, the Bureau did work closely with the Foreign Office in the preparation of white books. Johannes Golcha himself did most of the talking with the Foreign Office, mainly with Kurt Jagow, head of the Archive Commission. Sometimes Rudolf Lehmann intervened in order to add weight to Golsch's arguments. It was Lehman who forwarded to the Foreign Office the Bureau's report titled War Crimes in Crete. In a letter dated 16 September 1941, he turned the tables by advising that the material could not be published by the Foreign Office without prior permission. Quote, any use of the material dealt with in this exposé, as well as of the material on Russian war crimes, requires observance of the censorship guidelines issued by the propaganda department of the Wehrmacht High Command. Publication in Germany of the material on war crimes in Crete requires also the approval of the Air Minister and Commander-in-Chief of the Luftwaffe, unquote. The next section is headed Evaluation of German White Books. The evidentiary value of German White Books during World War II varies greatly. Some consist almost exclusively of sworn witness testimony, as complied by the War Crimes Bureau. These can be said to be fairly reliable, whereas those white books, including everything from newspaper articles to Gestapo reports, must be taken cum grano salis, or other words, with a grain of salt. The first two German white books dealing with the war in Poland represent a nadir of bad taste and cheap propaganda. On page 187 of, quote, The Polish Atrocities Against the Ethnic Germans in Poland, unquote, and on page 283 of the enlarged, quote, Documents of Polish Cruelty, unquote, appears a document, numbered 109, under the loud heading, quote, In the Hell of Boryska Kartuska, unquote. The editor simply reprinted a newspaper article from the Posner Tagblatt of 27 October 1939, taking it at face value as the credible report of a Mr. Kopiera, the former director of the Schicht plant in Warsaw, purporting to establish the murder of 158 Germans at the Boryska Kartuska internment camp. This document, in documents in quotes, was included even though a thorough investigation on the spot had disproved the allegations. In November 1939, a special commission made up of two military judges, a medical doctor, members of a propaganda company, and two foreign journalists had been sent to investigate whether 12 to 15 German pilots had in fact been killed at Boryska Kartuska. Although the commission's report appears to have been lost, the files of the Foreign Office show that Gunther Altenburg had sent a representative to join the commission and report back to the Foreign Office. According to his account, the pilots were not executed at all, but were sent on a transport to Pinsk. The commission further established that though many ethnic Germans at Boryska Kartuska had been beaten and otherwise mistreated, only three had been killed. In his report of 6 January 1940, Altenburg summed up, quote, The conclusions of this official commission do not substantiate the allegation in document 109 that 158 Germans were murdered at Boryska Kartuska. I do not think it is possible, in view of the commission's thoroughness and its method of interrogating witnesses, that such an event as the murder of so many Germans could have escaped attention, unquote. In light of this finding, several members of the Foreign Office pleaded for the removal of the document. On 10th January 1940, Ambassador Hans Dieckhoff wrote directly on the report. He wrote, quote, Now as ever, I believe that an official publication should contain only such documents as are absolutely correct. If the atrocities are true, they should be published. If they are not entirely true, they should not be published, unquote. But a day later, Counselor Günther Lohse of the press department contended that it would be too expensive to take the document out of the White Book, and anyway, the Foreign Office had already pointed out in a footnote that an official investigation of the case was still in progress. Thus, it was decided to keep the objectionable document 109 so as not to delay publication of the German language version of the White Book. Loza did propose taking it out of all foreign language editions, and in fact it is missing in the English version, which is titled Polish Acts of Atrocity Against the German Minority in Poland, and which was published in New York in the spring of 1940. Besides this kind of false information, there were more serious manipulations and exaggerations. For instance, the original manuscript version of the White Book spoke of 5,437 murdered Germans. The published edition claims 58,000 dead and missing. The official figure fabricated by Goebbels for his propaganda machine. In implementing this political falsification, the German Foreign Office had to telegraph its embassies in Washington, Buenos Aires, Rio de Janeiro, and elsewhere, quote, on page 17, line 10, from the top, insert the figure 58,000 instead of 5,000. This internal message did not become known until after the war, but in other countries there was so much skepticism about German allegations that the White Book on Poland had little propagandistic success. Moreover, the Polish government in exile had been faster in publishing its own Black Book, denouncing the widespread and indiscriminate killings perpetrated by German SS and SD soldiers in occupied Poland. So they said, you know, how correct were they? But going on, other reasons why the German White Books met with hostility in neutral countries include their racist tone, the clumsy attempt to make all Polish people and soldiers appear to be Untermenschen, or common criminals exposed the White Books as reckless compilations of hate propaganda, not worth attention or discussion. Instead of letting documents speak for themselves, the editors added shrill absurdities, such as, quote, after all this, we should not be surprised that Poland, in waging war, failed to observe the simplest rules of international law and of humanity, for which the Poles substituted bestial terror and animal subhumanity, unquote. Although not quite so extreme, the White Book, called Documents of British and French Atrocities, also contained a number of improbable allegations. Again, there was the problem of timing. Alleged British and French atrocities had to be collected as soon as possible, even if more speed meant less accuracy. On 4th June 1940, Altenburg telegraphed the German consul in Holland, and he said, the foreign minister has directed that a White Book on cases of pillage, arson, evacuations, and other atrocities committed by British and French soldiers be immediately compiled. Testimony should be in the form of protocols and should be sent together with pictures to the Foreign Office immediately, unquote. The White Book contains a number of sworn depositions, but the bulk of the published material consists of unconfirmed reports and allegations. In the years 1941 and 1942, the Foreign Office published a White Book on the war in Crete and three on the war in Russia. These consisted primarily of sworn witness testimony compiled and verified by the War Crimes Bureau, and therefore may be taken more seriously as historical sources. On 24 November 1942, the Foreign Office asked the government of Switzerland, as protecting power, to deliver to the British government the official German White Book titled Violations of International Law by British Forces and by the Civilian Population of Crete, as a form of official German protest. Because a year and a half had elapsed since the fighting in Crete, investigations by the British government were hardly to be expected. Moreover, the British Foreign Office had already responded to the general accusations in the German press in the summer of 1941, after making a number of inquiries among the British senior officers involved. An internal evaluation dated 5 November 1941 had summed up, quote, "At the time of the fighting in Crete and shortly thereafter, the Germans accused British troops, as well as the Cretans, of numerous atrocities. On the authority of General Freyberg and other senior officers, it was stated that after full investigation, German claims were proved to be without foundation." Unquote. Two more years would elapse before the British Foreign Office again had occasion to go back to the German White Book on Crete, after the Germans repeated their accusations in a diplomatic note dated 5 September 1944. This time, however, the legal advisor at the British Foreign Office, Patrick Dean, made an interesting admission in an internal memorandum dated 10 November 1944. It read, quote, "The breaches of the rules of war alleged against British troops have been made the subject of a German white book, and as far as I remember, a number of instances appear to be fairly well established." Unquote. This comment remained internal, of course, but it shows that the British were taking seriously the witness testimony compiled by the Wehrmacht War Crimes Bureau, even if they had not believed the wilder accusations in the German press 3 years earlier. Well, I have to say that this whole section sounds to me pro-British and anti-German. In an effort to be fair and accurate, he sometimes goes overboard, it seems to me. The final section in this chapter is titled Photographic Evidence. Whenever possible, the Bureau tried to obtain photographic evidence to accompany witness testimony. Most of the pictures, often of poor quality, were taken by individual soldiers with their own cameras. Sometimes a member of a propaganda company could be called to the scene in order to produce more professional photographs illustrating the case investigated. The Bureau made these pictures available to the Foreign Office, which used them extensively in the two white books on Poland. They were so shocking, however, that they detracted from the propagandistic effect. As the German embassy at Bern reported on 3rd May 1940 to the Foreign Office, quote, "We have frequently observed that the recipients of the White Book in Switzerland get upset not about the atrocities committed by the Poles, but about our publishing such horror pictures," unquote. Wow. In the course of the war in Russia, the Bureau received photographs of thousands of killings and mutilations, which Golcha, as usual, made available to the Archive Commission at the Foreign Office. On 8 September 1941, however, Jagow responded on behalf of the Archive Commission that Foreign Minister Joachim von Ribbentrop had decided against their publication. Thus, the three Russian white books consist preponderantly of witness testimony, though pictures were again used to illustrate those on Katyn and Vinnytsia. This short chapter just seems to illustrate to me that the Germans were damned if they did and damned if they didn't, as is usually the case. But I admit that I am somewhat biased in favor of Germany, and maybe that's why I think that. So we'll go on to Chapter 8, the use of Bureau investigations. This time, diplomatic protection is the focal point. When nations at war sever direct relations, any further diplomatic contact between them is usually achieved through a neutral state chosen as a protecting power. At the beginning of World War II, Great Britain chose the United States as protecting power, while Germany asked the government of Switzerland to represent German interests in Great Britain. When Germany declared war on the United States in December of 1941, Switzerland became protecting power for all three belligerents. Diplomatic exchange between Germany and the Soviet Union was far less conventional. This section is headed "The Third Reich and the Anglo-Americans." One of the tasks of a protecting power is to communicate one government's accusations of another's violation of international law. The German Foreign Office, for instance, would send a note to the German embassy in Bern, Switzerland. The embassy would transmit that note to the Swiss Foreign Office, called the Federal Political Department, which would telegraph the note to the Swiss embassy in London or Washington, which would bring it to the attention of the British or American government. After due investigation, an official answer would be drafted by the Foreign Office, or the U.S. Department of State, and telegraphed to its embassy in Bern for delivery to the Swiss Federal Political Department, which would complete the circle by informing the German Foreign Office through the Swiss embassy in Berlin. Although the Undersecretary of State, Ernst von Weizsäcker, in the German Foreign Office, once told Swiss Minister Hans Frilliker during a meeting in Berlin, that the Reich did not consider it worthwhile for a belligerent state to make official protests to another belligerent state, the Reich did, in fact, make frequent use of this old custom of international relations. However, as Weizsäcker put it, quote, the Reich limits itself to a statement of the facts for the protection of its legal position, unquote. Thus, the Germans avoided the use of the word protest by renaming their diplomatic notes, communication of the government of the Reich, to the protecting power. These communications were, of course, traditional protest notes, which the Reich asked the protecting power to transmit to the British or American government. The German Foreign Office obtained its information about violations of the laws of war from many sources, first of all through the War Crimes Bureau, but also through its own liaison officers at the high command of the Army, Navy, and Air Force, in the Wehrmacht Propaganda Department, and with the armies in the field. The Bureau, however, besides making its documents available to the Foreign Office, often itself recommended lodging a protest with the protecting power, and sometimes prepared the draft of the note. Perhaps the most frequent cause of protest was the treatment of German prisoners of war, one of the most celebrated cases being the shackling of German soldiers taken prisoner by British commandos at Dieppe in August 1942. Another case involved the misuse of German POWs on dangerous assignments close to the front line. On 20th December 1944, the Bureau sent to the Wehrmacht operations staff a copy of the sworn deposition of Private Hans Greiss, who alleged that he and other German POWs had been forced to dig trenches at the American battlefront close to Kirchberg, Jülich, in November 1944. Greiss stated that he and his comrades had been compelled to work under German artillery fire, and that the resulting casualties included 2 dead, and 20 wounded. Golcher recommended lodging a diplomatic protest against the British and American governments. Quote, since this case entails a very serious violation of the Convention on the Treatment of Prisoners of War, Articles 7 and 9, unquote. The operations staff passed the recommendation to the German Foreign Office, which agreed, and transmitted an official protest on 26 January 1945. As in previous cases, the U.S. Department of State took the matter seriously and had an on-the-spot investigation carried out. However, the report of the Office of the Inspector General of the U.S. Ninth Army, dated 25th April 1945, concluded that, quote, the purported facts given in the protest are too indefinite, contradictory, and lacking in plausibility to warrant further investigation, unquote. Evidently, because several towns have the name Kirchberg, and because of the time that had elapsed, there was great difficulty in finding anyone who knew anything at all about Greiss or about the practices he described. Other German protests dealt with Anglo-American air warfare, especially with the alleged bombing and machine gunning of ambulances, hospital trains, and field hospitals. The Bureau files report a great many such attacks in Italy. On 30th November 1944, the Bureau forwarded 3 sworn depositions. Quote, in view of the increased frequency of Anglo-American attacks on medical units, we advocate lodging protests against both the United States and Great Britain. The nationality of the planes involved can be determined with certainty only in a few instances. Unquote. On 6 December 1944, the German embassy in Bern delivered a long note protesting 12 air attacks on German medical units in Italy during the 6 weeks from 1 September to 16 October 1944 by British and or American fighter bombers. The note emphasized that the German armed forces had taken every precaution to make army medical establishments clearly recognizable even to high-speed aircraft. Moreover, all the attacks listed had taken place in good weather and far from any legitimate military targets. Identical notes were transmitted by the protecting power to London and Washington. They said, the government of the Reich expects that the British or American government will not only make a thorough investigation and call the guilty parties to account, but also prevent the recurrence of such infractions of international law by the immediate issue of more stringent orders to strictly observe the Geneva Convention. Unquote. Upon receipt of this note, the British and American governments ordered the investigation of all 12 cases. On 11 February 1945, British Air Vice Marshal R.M. Foster reported that British planes had definitely not been involved in 9 of the attacks complained of. In 2 others, British planes had in fact been on strafing missions, but in 1 case the pilot had not seen any Red Cross markings on the buildings, and in the other did not see them until after the attack had been completed. On 13 February 1945, the U.S. Adjutant General's office reported that a full investigation revealed responsibility in only 2 cases. At 8:10 hours, the flight began a strafing run on 5 or 6 vehicles, not until the leader's machine gun fire had driven one of the vehicles off the road was he close enough to discern red crosses marked on the vehicles. He immediately ceased firing and ordered the rest of the flight mission to hold their fire. At 15:45 hours, a vehicle was fired on by this flight. It was only after the vehicle had been strafed that it was recognized as an ambulance. No further attacks were made after the Red Crosses were distinguished. Unquote. Well, I would imagine that in February 1945, they were not being too careful and not too concerned at all with following the Geneva Conventions. But to go on. On the basis of these reports, the U.S. War Department explained the attacks to the State Department, which in turn transmitted a statement to the Swiss minister in charge of German interests in the United States. Quote, because of the nature of these attacks, it was virtually impossible to see the Red Cross markings until after the attacks had begun. Had the pilots taken more time to examine each target at close range prior to attack, they would have been subjected to prolonged enemy fire. Whenever the markings were seen, the attacks were immediately broken off. Unquote. Well, that's a very good excuse that can always be made. The complaint and investigation procedure functioned in similar manner with respect to the bombardment of a hospital at Dunkirk in October of 1944. The German legation in Bern transmitted the following note to the protecting power on 1 November 1944. It read, the commander of the German base at Dunkirk, currently under British siege, reports that when negotiating with the commanders of the British troops for a short armistice to permit the evacuation of the civilian population from the city, he also asked them to spare the hospitals in Dunkirk, to which the British agreed. When, shortly thereafter, on 14 October, A hospital was subjected to artillery fire and damaged. The German commander of Dunkirk officially protested to the British commander. In spite of this, another hospital was again bombarded at night, although there were no military objectives in the vicinity. There were also wounded British soldiers in the hospital. Since the German commander had informed the British troops about the exact location of the hospitals in Dunkirk, it is presumed that the bombardment was deliberate and not mere stray shots. End of the note that was transmitted to the British. 1 month later, on 2nd December 1944, the British government informed the protecting power, that is, this is their answer, His Majesty's government have made the fullest inquiry into the incident referred to by the German government. As a result, it has been established that no shell fire was aimed at the hospitals or hospital areas notified by the German commander to the British commander at Dunkirk. Far from there having been no military target in the vicinity, there were, in fact, legitimate targets within 300 yards and 500 yards from the hospital concerned, and the attention of the German commander was drawn to the fact that these and other targets were very close to the hospital line. His Majesty's government declare, therefore, that British artillery fire has not been directed at the hospital areas indicated by the German commander in Dunkirk, and reiterate that it is their invariable practice to respect the immunity of hospitals under international law. End of the response from the British. At this point, it would be well to mention that on numerous occasions, the British and American governments, on their own initiative, communicated to the Swiss government such occurrences as they thought involved a violation of international law by their own troops. For example, on 19 November 1944, the British legation in Bern conveyed to the Swiss government a communication regarding the sinking of the German hospital ship Tübingen in the Adriatic south of Pola. The German government did not submit its official protest until 24 November 1944, 5 days later. And again, when some 140 German prisoners of war died of suffocation on 15th March 1945, while being transported from one POW camp to another in France, the United States government decided to inform the protective power immediately. On 18 March 1945, General Dwight D. Eisenhower telegraphed to General George C. Marshall, quote, I have not yet found out the cause of the death of the German prisoners recently reported to me, nor do I know who is responsible. It is irritating to have such things occur, because I certainly loathe having to apologize to the Germans. It looks as if this time I have no other recourse, unquote. Boy, that's an interesting statement for history. After consultations with the British government, the American legation in Bern conveyed a communication to the Swiss government that said, with the approval of the State Department, Eisenhower addressed a statement to the German High Command expressing regret over the deaths of the POWs and promising a full inquiry into the case and punishment of those responsible. It looks like it was something done on purpose that they were having to accept and take the blame for. We're not going to learn anything more about that. Yeah, that's the end of what we're going to learn about that. Continuing on, the German Foreign Office continued processing documents from the War Crimes Bureau and churning out protest notes until the very last weeks of the war. One of the latest bears the date 25th March 1945, barely 6 weeks before the final collapse of the Reich. To the post-war historian, it may seem remarkable indeed that while most of the Reich was occupied by Allied troops, and the Russians were preparing for the final assault on Berlin, the Foreign Office could serenely issue a diplomatic note protesting 11 attacks on medical facilities in Italy. Here's one, says, The German government has repeatedly had occasion to protest to the British and United States governments concerning violations of the Geneva Convention for the Protection of the Wounded and Sick of Armies in the Field. The latest reports listed below, substantiated by witness testimony under oath and by trustworthy accounts of witnesses, have strengthened the conviction of the German government that these continued attacks constitute intentional, systematic violations of the above-mentioned convention. The German government requests that the incidents be investigated, that appropriate action be taken against the guilty, and that all measures be taken to ensure that such totally inexcusable incidents will not recur. End of that protest. The next section is headed, the last section of this chapter, is headed the Third Reich and the Soviets. Diplomatic protection as it functioned between Germany and the United States and between Germany and Great Britain never materialized between the two great European totalitarian powers. Neither Hitler nor Stalin wanted it, he writes. Early in the hostilities between them, however, the Soviet Union did approach Sweden and Germany approached Bulgaria for very limited protecting power services. On 19 July 1941, the Swedish legation in Berlin conveyed a Soviet note of 17 July offering to observe the rules of war set out in the Hague Convention 4 of 18 October 1907. If the German government would do likewise. Because the Soviet government had abrogated all treaties signed by the Tsarist regime, the convention would not apply to its soldiers without some such gesture. And in parentheses, he writes, the Soviet government did not, however, offer to subscribe to the Geneva Convention of 27 July 1929, which it had never signed. Of course, it is an open question whether the Soviet Union made the offer in good faith or whether this was no more than one of its frequent propaganda ploys. Whatever the case, the German government did not take the offer seriously. Whereas in other theaters of war, the killing of prisoners had been a rare exception, thousands of German POWs had already been liquidated by Soviet forces during the first weeks of fighting. In the light of this experience, which was extensively documented by the War Crimes Bureau, Germany considered the Soviet suggestion a kind of bad joke, as the official answer of the Foreign Office indicated. Here's the answer from the German Foreign Office. The German government can only express its utter astonishment at the fact that the Soviet government considers itself justified in referring to the observance of international law rules with respect to the treatment of prisoners of war, and thereby to bring up the question of reciprocity in spite of the conduct thus far shown by Soviet soldiers toward German prisoners of war. The state of the corpses of German soldiers found by advancing German troops and the testimony of German soldiers who have fallen in Russian hands and then been liberated, established that Soviet soldiers have murdered and tortured German prisoners in bestial and indescribable fashion. End of that protest. At approximately the same time, the International Committee of the Red Cross transmitted to the German Foreign Office a statement by the Soviet Red Cross protesting German air attacks on Soviet field hospitals. As a matter of course, the German Foreign Office passed the complaint on to the legal department of the German Air Ministry. It said, in order to respond to the Soviet allegations with greater propagandistic impact, it is necessary to determine which cities mentioned in the telegram are now in German hands and whether investigations on the spot can yield evidence to show the untruth of the allegations. Such evidence can be submitted eventually to representatives of the International Committee of the Red Cross for rechecking and may be used for other purposes. Unquote. On 23rd July 1941, the High Command of the Air Force responded with a tone of indignation. It is wholly out of question that the Luftwaffe may have deliberately attacked hospitals or medical transports. In view of the well-known Soviet practice of destroying everything behind them, it is more likely that the Soviets have themselves destroyed their own hospitals. Moreover, the Luftwaffe refuses to devote any attention to Soviet protests with respect to the observance of the Geneva Convention or of the Prisoners of War Convention, since the Soviets have thus far conducted themselves in a manner totally outside international law. As proof, we enclose for your information, but not for publication, a number of photographs and the transcript of a report dealing with the torture of German pilots and the murder of members of the Luftwaffe in Lvov. End of correspondence. This internal communication reflects the subjective conviction on the part of German officers that the Red Army did not observe the laws of war, notwithstanding the representations made by the Soviet government to the Swedish protecting power. It was therefore with little expectation of success that the German Foreign Office, from the beginning of the campaign in Russia, took repeated steps to inquire into the fate of German soldiers missing in action and believed to be in Russian captivity. On 20th August 1941, it informed the legal department of the Wehrmacht and the Special Bureau for Foreign Intelligence that the Bulgarian Foreign Office had been approached as intermediary and that the Bulgarian legation in Moscow was attempting to establish whether there existed a prisoner of war camp some 10 kilometers south of Moscow's Tushino Airport. The Bulgarian legation was further asked to try to arrange a visit to this and other camps by the International Committee of the Red Cross, which had already inspected prisoner of war camps for Russian soldiers in Germany. As expected, however, the Soviet government informed the Bulgarian legation that it declined to answer such inquiries. The ICRC, which had offered all belligerents its services in exchanging lists of prisoners of war and communicating messages, was similarly refused permission to visit POW camps in the Soviet Union, nor did it receive any lists of prisoners, even though the governments of Finland, Italy, Hungary, Romania, and the Reich had transmitted the names of Soviet prisoners of war. This lack of reciprocity led to the Reich's decision to discontinue the practice of communicating names to the ICRC. In the incomplete records of the War Crimes Bureau and the German Foreign Office, no other instances of quasi-protecting power activities with respect to the Soviet Union are to be found. Given the character of the confrontation between Hitler and Stalin, any attempt at diplomatic intervention was almost a priori condemned to failure, since each totalitarian belligerent was committed to annihilating the other at whatever cost. Restrictions on the way to total victory were considered a waste of time. This is the end of Chapter 8, and as far as I'm going to go in today's program, but I have to comment about a couple of things here. First, the last paragraph of this chapter shows us that our author, Alfred de Zayas, for all the good that he has done in producing this compilation of information here for us, equates Hitler and Stalin as two of a kind. That it was only Hitler and Stalin that sought total victory at whatever cost, when we know very well that England and America were at the end of total victory and demanded unconditional surrender from early on in the war from Germany. De Zayas is biased against the government of Adolf Hitler in everything he writes, even though he is very sympathetic to the German people and German soldiers and to the German Wehrmacht even, because he thinks that they were in large part not pro-Hitler. So it's unfortunate. But at least we can say that there is no way that he's trying to make the Hitler regime look good in this book. So whatever little truth about how German soldiers and the German armies were treated by the Allies, whatever little bit of it that he gets in this book, at least we know that it's absolutely authentic. And we also saw earlier in this chapter that the Allies cared little and made every excuse they could come up with for the way that they misused the Geneva Convention and didn't follow the laws of war in their own behavior. So this is what Germany was up against, and it was completely unfair. But as they say, nothing is fair in the United Nations system of world order that Alfred Dzhias does serve in the end, in spite of how much he might disagree with it in certain instances. So next week I will do chapters 9 and 10, which is a couple pages more than what I read for this program. And until then, I want to once again thank you for listening and following this series. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and the date is July 6th. See you next time.